Harry's Razors.
Hey, Don, I have a question for you.
Ready.
You know, we've been using Harry's Razors for many years now. Why do you like Harry's beyond what you used to use?
The smooth shave and the feeling afterwards. I didn't have any shaving cream with me. It didn't matter. Just with water, this razor just cuts through a beard.
Well, there's five blades. I don't know if you've counted them or not, but there's five blades that are German engineered that really are pretty darn sharp, and they stay sharp. That's the crazy thing, right? I noticed that they last longer.
I change them out of just curiosity whether the next one will be sharper.
Yeah. 'Cause
it seems like by now this should be dull.
And you would think logically that those blades would cost you a lot more, but they actually cost you less. If you're going on, once you join the Harry's family and you're just reordering blades, it's less than $2 a blade.
Yeah, and they last a long time, and it is the shave of a lifetime.
So we've been talking about some of the special deals that we have for Trail Runner Nation family members, but we have a new one, and we've talked about it a couple times. And what that is if you go to their website, just anybody goes to their website, they can get a free trial, which is a handle, some shaving cream or gel, and some blades. Okay,
right. How much?
If it's for free,
okay.
All you do is pay $3 for shipping.
Yeah.
Okay. If you use the code TRN, you get the bonus, which is something that we've talked about.
The aftershave lotion.
The balm.
The balm.
The aftershave balm. Mm-hmm. So get it. You can get the blade. You can get a handle. You can get the either the gel or the shaving foam and a bottle of the balm for $3.
That is the balm.
Go to harrys.com.
Science shows the health conscious deserve lower rates on life insurance. Makes sense. If you know more about your health, you're going to be able to take care of yourself. And Scott, if I was within a pool of people, I would want the people that I'm sharing risk with to be healthy and to be active.
And you should get a reward. You're putting in a lot of training, a lot of effort out there. You should be able to get some kind of a break.
You know, Scott, on healthiq.com, the website, they talk a little bit about the benefits of all kinds of activities. So I clicked on runners because obviously that's what we're interested in. And some of the items they have on here, if you run 2 marathons per year, you're 41% less likely to suffer from high blood pressure. Or how about this, Scott? If you've run 2 marathons per year, you are 87% less likely to be a diabetic than non-marathoners.
So if that all makes sense, why should you, as a runner, be paying the same premiums, the same amount for life insurance that someone that doesn't run?
Well, you shouldn't. Listen to this one, Scott. If you're a runner versus non-runner, and that's defined as running 2 marathons per year, you're 41% less likely to suffer from high blood pressure. And that's one of the reasons I run, because my blood pressure is much more controlled when I run.
So what Health IQ does is they work with A-rated carriers, and they use science and data to negotiate the best rates for us. So if you go to healthiq.com/TRN.
So not only be part of a trail running community, but also a pool of healthy people that are experiencing fantastic life insurance rates at reduced cost.
Because you're healthier.
That's it.
Go to healthiq.com/TRN.
Hey, Scott, it's time. We've got some gear up on the TRN in the store, yeah?
We have some, and we will have more very shortly.
The store's growing, is what you're telling me.
We have the buffs. We have the sleeves, which we're getting rave reviews about. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, within the next week, we will have our new T-shirts and hoodies for the fall coming up.
And hats are on the way?
And if this hat that we've been working on for probably about 6 months turns out half as good as I think it will,
yeah,
you're going to want to. One to wear on the training days and one to wear on race days.
Nice.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true, Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even you have no idea.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's yeah.
I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name's Scott Ward.
And I'm Don Freeman. And with us today, Joe Juhan from Eugene, Oregon. And we're happy to have him here. Joe, as you may have come across some of Joe's writings on I Run Far, he is a regular contributor there. You may have come across him at his blogspot, joejuhanblogspot.com, and read some of his musings about various trail things, about running efficiency, about whatever is on his mind. You may have come across him if you're fast. In 2011 and 12, he was a first overall at the Autumn Leaves 50-50. In 2012, Western States top 10 finisher, came in ninth place there. And in 2014, a 24-hour run, Elijah Bristow in Oregon. He was running for 24 hours. I want to talk to him about that. How do you pace yourself knowing that you're just running constantly? And
How far did he go? I'm interested.
I didn't quite do 24 hours. I only did the 6 hour that day. That's a little bit of a misnomer.
When you can run the speed that Joe runs, you can run what most people do in 24 hours, in 6 hours. So well done.
Perfect.
And in 2016, the Superior Fall Trail Race, September 9th, 2nd overall. That's a 100-mile run. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here.
Hey, you didn't mention he's also a regular contributor on our favorite periodical, Ultra Running Magazine.
And I didn't mention that you might find him at a physical therapy clinic in Eugene, Oregon, helping people run better and more efficiently.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hey Joe, I want to jump right in. Do you mind if I jump in?
No, Mom? I think we should probably involve Joe somehow.
I just want to jump in because in the latest issue of Ultra Running Magazine, which is November, we're in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
He has an article titled "Central Governor and Stride," and I was hooked by the first phrase of this article where he says it's simple but it's not easy. He talks about running gait, running form. And it comes down to it. It is so simple, but when I run with Don, I see his running stride and it's just very, very efficient, very good. And I have to concentrate on just that to even get remotely close to a good biomechanics. So talk to us a little bit about this article and what you're trying to help us understand.
Well, going back to this calendar year in ultra running, the focus of my column has been on efficiency and just the biomechanics. And what makes ultra running so interesting in general is that it's not just running, and especially when you're on trails, there's so many factors that interplay with that. So looking at all these different elements of running stride efficiency, but then how the ultra distance and how the terrain and the gear and the nutrition and all those things can impact that. So, you know, we covered the foundational components in the beginning of the year, and then we began to kind of go into, okay, well, what are these kind of big challenges? And for me in the clinic, it's like, what are the things that are the biggest or most common things that I come across? And that's what this column was about, was why is it so hard to lean forward and to lift your legs? Like, that's running. It should be really easy. But it's the two biggest things that I see clinically as being issues in someone having aches and pains with running, or even, you know, performance-related issues in ultras. So then I got to thinking about that, and it's like, well, there's got to be some reason why it's preferential to not lean forward and not lift your leg up. And that's when I came to the central governor theory. And for those of you that don't know what that is, it basically is this theory that the brain is trying to protect you, and that for better or worse, the brain will always do what's most important to protect the system and to protect itself. And so what that article was, at least my theory on why it's so hard to lean forward and lift your hip, is that when you do those things, you put the brain in danger, especially on a trail. Think about a technical descent. going downhill, you don't really want to lean forward, and you don't want to lift your leg too high up in the air. That increases the likelihood you might fall.
So the brain is actually taking over and saying, you know what, we're really in control here, and there's no leaning forward and risking hitting this melon of ours on a tree branch or a rock. We're going to hang back here and just watch all this happen.
Well, I think that just like a lot of things, I mean, we would never be able to achieve anything athletically if we couldn't override that protective tendency. Hmm. So being able to be in utter pain, whether it's running a mile race on the track or a 100-miler, and being able to push through pain, the central governor theory with performance is the brain creates fatigue and creates pain to protect you and say, hey, what you're doing isn't safe, slow down or stop. And if you can kind of convince your system, no, I'm going to keep going, you can overcome that. But gosh, in the latter stages of a 100-miler, the brain is going to be telling you slow down, but it's also going to be telling you lean back and start shuffling. So, it's you have to really be thinking about it to kind of overcome that.
So, Joe, I agree with that 100%. But don't you think that the brain that is trying to protect your body would also help you biomechanically default to an efficient running form? Let's say you're not going down a hill and at risk of taking a tumble and endo onto your forehead, but you're running on a flat, relatively groomed trail. Don't you think that the brain would almost help default to an efficient running stance? Instead of hanging back, it would say, hey, I want to protect my quads, I want to protect myself from injury, run in a good form.
Well, I think it has to prioritize, and the most pressing danger is in the immediate. So okay. and that's kind of the tragic part of the central governor theory, is that it will sacrifice long-term efficiency for short-term safety.
Interesting.
So for me, when I feel this the most is when I'm doing track repeats. If I'm doing hard quarters or something, if I lean forward the way that I'm supposed to, it feels like, especially when I'm going really hard, it feels like I'm just going to crumble into the track and just go head first. Hmm. So, but at the same time, I run faster and I feel better having run with that mechanic. But the brain's like, no, we just don't want you to plow on the ground. We don't care what happens to the quad muscle. So I really, it is almost kind of like a selfish brain. And that's one of the articles that I wrote in Iron Far a few years ago, and how it is. It's the brain is selfish. It doesn't necessarily care about muscles or joints or the other things or quad cramping at mile 80, as long as you're not falling down in the immediate.
Joe, do you naturally have good running form and run efficiently, or do you have to work at it?
I don't think I would know a quarter of what I've learned if I was naturally good at this stuff. And I think so many of the problems that I've had and the issues and the challenges are what I've learned from most, where my own running and my own time on the trail is like a laboratory for a lot of the ideas that I have or the clinical things that I'm trying with people. So, no, I think there's components of my running where I do have some natural abilities, and I'm really thankful for that. But my definition of athleticism or athletic talent is the ability to learn something quickly and to be very consistent with it.
Oh, that's good.
And so, a running stride is like a golf swing. And I've had times when I go golfing, I'm like, wow, my swing is just wonderful. This is great. I'm shooting, you know, like a 40. And then like a week later, it's terrible. So there's that athleticism that comes from just the consistent efficiency. And that's the big challenge that I have. You know, and I think a lot of athletes do as well.
A little sidebar here. You know, we've talked about on this podcast many times with many of our good guests that this decrease in running form and improper efficiency is blamed a lot by the shoes that we wear. How much do you think is the shoes we wear versus this central governor theory in our brain?
Shoes can play a role, but less than we think.
Okay.
And the reason is that, and what I think we're going to eventually find out in the mainstream, is the maximum cushion shoes allow us to get away with habits in the short term that maybe we shouldn't do in the long term. So the funny thing is I think what you're referring to is someone will say, well, in so-and-so of a shoe with too much heel and too much whatever, like it causes some aches and pains or issues. And that may be, and I think part of the message that resonated from Once a Runner is, or excuse me, from, okay, I'm blanking on what book that is. I've got it in my, not Born to Run, I'm sorry, is that, oh, we need to get more natural. Let's get away from hyper-engineering and more, and less is more. And I think that's definitely true, where you lose the feeling for what your body is supposed to be doing with the ground. But when it comes to max cushioning shoes, I think that is also happening, where you're not feeling when you're being inefficient. And I just saw I've seen a couple studies now that say very simply, if you run quieter, it's less stress on your legs.
You know,
that's just a big idea.
You know, and I've commented about that on the podcast too, of trying to sneak up on some people that are ahead of you, seeing how long it takes before they're aware that you're coming up behind them. And I know when my gait's cleaner and more efficient, I can do that a bit better. I might remind us that when we're out shoe shopping, that our brain's still involved. And it's setting ourselves up for that maximum cushion. I can get a little away with a little more stuff. I mean, you can never let your guard down.
That's why you buy the pretty ones, Don.
The brain is always, always involved.
Hey,
so let me ask you this, Joe. How often do you take your gait and film it and analyze it?
Not as much as I should. But I have a partner who is also a runner, Callie Cooper, who won Waldo this year. So, and she is as invested in running efficiency as I am. So what really helps me is when she and I are running together, if I'm doing something weird that I'm, or inefficient that I'm not aware of, she'll point it out and vice versa. And I would love, as a running community, if we could, number one, increase awareness of like just some general things, which is kind of what the goal of Ultra Running Magazine this year was, just increasing some awareness of these basic things. But then as like a running community, okay, you're running in a group of people and somebody's doing something weird, tell them. I mean, it's kind of like having food on your face. You don't want to be swinging that elbow way out and the other one's just fine and you're going along and all your friends are like, oh my gosh, can you see that guy? What's Fred doing? Like we shouldn't be doing that. We should be helping each other out. So sometimes, it's as easy as that. And you don't even have to have a biomechanical scientific eye to know, you're doing something kind of weird that maybe a week ago or a month ago, or you weren't doing.
Yeah. I definitely think that, Scott, we should go out and film and watch ourselves. And Joe, I believe in one of your articles, you set up some of the parameters for that. You need a camera that's 30 feet away or so from the person. Why don't you go over a couple of those things in case others might be motivated to do what, I should be doing.
Well, when I do my running stride analysis work, which is a remote service that I offer, essentially what I am looking for clients who submit video is I want a side view, a clean side view, which is non-panning. So the camera is just basically, imagine like you're standing in the infield of a track or a sideline of a track, and that person just runs straight through the frame. So you're pointed perpendicular to them. And to have a good 10 or so strides should be enough to just see what's the right leg doing, what's the left leg doing. And then a simple front and back view where, again, using the track idea, you're standing in lane one and somebody is standing right in front of you. They run away 30 meters, turn around and run right back at you. And those two views are really the two most foundational views, and you'll be able to see, okay, what does the shape look like? And we talked about that, you know, early on in the columns in ultra running this year. Are you forward? Are you using your hips? Are you using your arms? Where's your foot landing? And then if you're doing anything kind of weird, that rear view is really nice. I have a problem with leaning, where late in races, especially because of some hip weakness that I have, is my trunk will go left. And I don't realize it. I don't even, until it's too late, until I've got, you know, significant soreness. So that's a really nice view, that rear view, to see, okay, are you leaning to one side or is one knee buckling in? So those are, they're really simple views, but those are the two that I look for.
When you do this, do you have the runner do it fresh or after they have an hour of running underneath them? When is the best time to analyze that?
During a race.
Okay.
Maybe not. Maybe it's so far gone by then. Yeah, at least being warmed up.
Mile 99.
For me as a clinician, whenever I watch somebody run, I always know that that's their best behavior form.
Right.
So if I'm seeing something off and this is their best behavior, then I kind of extrapolate to what I call lowest common denominator form, which is, okay, you're still running, but you're tired and you're kind of getting a little bit clunky. So if someone films for me, I at least want them reasonably warmed up. And then I'm a little less specific about how far into the run, but also speeds. Because the other thing people will do is like, oh my gosh, they're watching me, I'm gonna run really, really fast. And I'm like, well, that's an argument for speed work, because most people, when they run fast, they actually do a lot better. It's when you get into the ultra distance speed that the inefficiencies start to come out. So I'll say, you know, come back with and show me what 50-mile, you know, ultra pace looks like. And so that's like, oh, okay. Because most of the people that contact me, they're either having issues related to marathon running or ultra running, or they're having a performance issue of like, oh, I cramp, or I have blown quads or blister issues, or I just can't handle the long run. So that's when you want to wonder is, okay, well, what do they look like at those speeds, at that, you know, 11-minute pace for several hours?
Yeah, and if you're wondering if you're starting to break down in your form, you can look back to some of the times that you catch a toe and you face plant. It's always later in the run. It's never in the beginning when you're actually lifting your leg and setting it down. It's more when you become a shuffler and a slider that you're end up with that. Look at the size of that rock that you tripped over. It's probably a quarter of an inch off the ground, and that thing took you down like some kind of demon.
That reminds me of my first Western States in 2011. I mean, I'd never been on the last 20 miles of Western States prior to the race because I was injured, and it was pitch dark, and I, like, that could have been like the gnarliest stretch of hard rock for how my stride was and how many times I clipped it. And then I go back the next year, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like a track. It doesn't take much when you get tired. And I'd never run that far my whole life before that first Western States in 11.
Hey, Joe, here's a tip for you. If you run slower, you can run that last section in the daylight like I did.
There you go.
I want to go back to that. Scott sent you through that log into the conversation.
Sorry, we can edit that.
We all started to think about running a 30-hour Western States and how painful that would be.
I want to go back to the earlier comment about that tug of war in the brain. You've got one central governor side, the smarter, the more rational side, and then you have the other ambitious in the side of the brain that really wants to get stuff done and accomplish a goal and find that finish line. And for all those maybe ego reasons or selfish reasons or just life's I'm going to say goals again because I only have about four words in my vocabulary. So that I think that's what's interesting about this endurance stuff, is that that whole contest that happens inside that skull of ours between the rational side and the irrational side, the central governor side and the goal oriented side. I just love that part about our sport.
The angel and demon on each shoulder.
Yeah, and it happens all but in that cranium.
Well, that's what I love about ultras so much, is that ultras provide a platform to experience that that sometimes even a marathon can't do. And I think it was Ann Trason who had said this, or something along these lines, about, you know, just the ups and downs, and you can feel good at 30 miles, but then feel even terrible at 40 miles, but then all of a sudden at 50 miles, you feel amazing. And from a physiology standpoint, that makes zero sense. Like, why would that be? But if you're having this tug of war with the central governor, who's spending the first 40 miles of the race trying to protect you, and then all of a sudden it's for one reason or another, it kind of lets go, then all of a sudden you do feel really good. And I think people come into ultra running in particular to challenge their limits and learn about themselves. And that's what I love about it. I love that feeling of running fast 60, 80 miles into a race.
And I think back to the central governor rational side. I think that you, if you're aware of that's what's happening in your head, that you can allow yourself to be irrational for a little while, then pull back, and you can let each side of the brain lead when it's important. Like, I, you know, I'm in a good spot here. I know the course. I know where I'm at. I'm going to go ahead and let this go for a bit and run a little harder. But then I need to listen to the rest of me that says, that's far enough. If you go any further, you're going to reach into your reserves and you're not going to be able to come back out. So during, during the race day, it's an interesting, I'll go back to tug of war match between those two sides. And that is what's fun about racing.
Well, I think that's what the elite runners do so well. They have the ability. It's not just about pushing through pain. I don't think they have necessarily more pain than the rest of us do, but they can ride that line and say, okay, well, I'm going to make it really hurt, and I'm going to just charge out of this canyon super hard, but then knowing I can rest a little bit and bring it back down on this flat. And that is a very fine line to ride.
I know there's been times when my fitness level was on the higher side that I almost felt like a passenger riding this vehicle, which was me, and being able to observe it more than just be inside of it. And I thought that was a good perception, but I had to be, have to be in pretty good shape to be a passenger in this vehicle and not a participant.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So I think one of the pieces that I was most proud of riding in the last, it's been almost 5 years at Hour and Far, was writing about Western States 2 years ago. And it was a two-part column, and I had interviewed a lot of people, including Tim Treatmeyer and Ann Trason and AJW, and this phrase, and Andy really was the one that brought it up time and again, was the marble in the groove. And they're, what they're really talking about is the flow state. And the flow state from a psychology standpoint is being just so present oriented. It's like you've got all these plates spinning and they're just perfectly spinning and you're just grooving. And that's when you can, I think that's what I think of when you say, okay, a passenger in my own body, is all these systems are just perfectly executed. So then you just let go. And I think that's always the goal, whether it's biomechanically or nutritionally or pacing, is if you can just kind of get everything set, those moments while fleeting are really amazing. I mean, it's not only fast running, but it's like this blissful state of you're just grooving, you're just going.
Mm-hmm. And with those seven plates in the air, one of the things that I've noticed that on training runs, if I forget music or some headphones, if I'm out there by myself, I'll run back to the car. Like, oh, I've got to go get that. But on race day, I may tuck those earphones underneath my shirt, but I won't pull them out because I'm busy managing those seven plates. Too much at risk not to keep my head in the game.
So are you saying that on your training runs you shouldn't be thinking about those seven plates?
No, I think I'm probably lazy and I'm willing to take the risk on a training run. But race day, it seems like I never have I have to have the music with me, but I don't have to listen to it because there's a lot to think about when you're out there.
Mm-hmm.
You have any thoughts on that, Joe?
One of the pieces from earlier this year in ultra running, you know, we talked about, well, everyone talks about, okay, you need to have a nutrition plan. What's your nutrition plan? What's your hydration plan? What's your gear plan going to be? What's your pace? Well, we should have a form plan too. And if you think about a nutrition plan, okay, well, here are the kind of the sugars that are easy, digestible, quick energy. I like this. I don't like that. If this goes bad, I'll eat this. And then maybe some other different, this is my 100-miler food. Andy could probably talk for an hour on all of his different strategies. But people have that plan. And what I advocate is the same thing with running mechanics, where you know what you need to do. Okay, here are these foundational things. And then here are my bad habits. So when I get tired or I get sloppy, I have this tendency. It might be a foot thing or a posture thing. And then it's like the go-to list. Okay, it's the end of the race and I'm really struggling. What can I do? Can I use my arms better? Can I lean forward? Can I lift the hips up so we don't trip on that pebble in the last 10 miles? So I don't think you have to be obsessive. And the people who talk about flow will say, yeah, it's actually thinking less. But to have a plan and to have some mindfulness goes a long way.
You know, you kind of answered that question, but I'm going to give you a two-part question. In thinking about running efficiency or running efficiently, are there, as a coach, are there some exercises that you do or you recommend for training? And then the second part of the question is, and I think you kind of answered it, is in your run strategy for running efficiency, are there certain exercises or movements that you would recommend help you check into your running form? Like for example, when I take a walk break as I'm either training or running, when I start to run again, I stop briefly and then lean forward at the ankles until I feel like I'm going to fall forward and then start my feet moving. So it gets me in that right form. Do you have any tips or tricks in that regard, Joe?
I think that is individualized, and it's just, you know, and you could bring the food nutrition analogy back and say, okay, well, there's some general things, but then, oh, you have to learn about what you need. Mm-hmm. So when I have a new coaching client come on, the first thing that we do is just do a basic running stride analysis. And the intent there isn't to change everything and you have to run this way and this is exactly what you have to do. It's more or less, okay, are you doing anything that's like truly inefficient? And are you demonstrating something in your stride that correlates with a previous performance issue? If you have constant quad issues or blister issues, oh, well, that lack of forward lean I'm seeing, well, that's relevant. So that's something we could go after. So that then usually tends to be whatever your sensitivity or need issue is as a runner, that's kind of where you need to go. And for most people, it is a degree of forward engagement. Although some people will overdo that, or they'll be too tall in their trunk, or they'll be too slouched. So there are some foundational things. I have a couple running drills that I really like. I don't know if you guys have heard of the 100 up. I just call it runner hops.
Yeah.
I had that was, I think, 3 years ago in Iron Far. I do have a video of me not doing it very well. But that's a drill where you can work on being forward. You can work on strong and quick hips. And I tend to give that out fairly frequently as a fundamental running stride exercise, but also kind of a nice warm-up.
So, Joe, if somebody wanted to get their gait analyzed by you, is that something that you provide that you can make available via online somehow?
Correct. So my new company that I started in July is Yuhan Performance, and basically my motivation was I'd been a staff physical therapist for 7 or 8 years, and I have also been doing running stride analysis in addition to full-time client coaching for a few years, and both of those were gradually growing to the point where I was trying to work less and less in the clinic, and my employer didn't really want me to work less. It's like, well, maybe I should just do this on my own. So at this point, my business is three pillars. I do traditional physical therapy treatment here in Eugene. I do full-time ultra and sub-ultra coaching. And then I do the running stride analysis. And how the running stride analysis works is it's usually people who are either looking to improve efficiency or have had some issue of like, oh, I've had five different injuries, but they're all on the left side. Or I've had this one Achilles issue and I can't run over a 10-mile long run, otherwise it flares up. So people will reach out to me, send videos in, and then we can kind of correlate, okay, well, you have this injury history, you have this performance issue, let's see what your stride looks like. And then based on that, I generate a report, okay, well, this is what I think is relevant, this is how I think we should adjust it. And then what makes that easier is giving them some mobility or stretching components, some strength exercises, some drills, because all of that will then reinforce whatever our strategy is. So if you have, let's say you have blister issues or calf cramping issues, and I see that you're running too upright and you're not lifting your hips, then we may do a hip stretch. We may do a little bit of core strengthening to go along with the 100 up running drill where you're practicing being tall and forward, and then your cue on the run is be tall and forward, or lift your hip or drive your hip a couple inches higher.
Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
I'm good. I'm good.
As we look at the people that are at the start line, who are some people that you admire just with fantastic form? And you look at them, you say, you know what? That is a natural, sweet gait. Who are some names that we might know?
Jim, he has the best hip mobility that I've seen of anyone doing long ultras. So, like, I went to the U.S. Mountain Running Championships in Bend, which is a short distance event, but it's still pretty heavy vertical. And what I noticed with those guys is they were running. They looked like they were sprinting with the sprint mechanics, the big forward lean, super strong, big hips, uphill and downhill. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm telling myself, it's like, well, you know, they're only running like 5 miles or so. But you look at videos of Jim Walmsley from Western States, he looked like that at Forest Hill. Mm-hmm. Holy crap. And he really serves to me as almost like a metric of the ideal. And what I wrote about in Iron Far this summer was people will say, oh, well, gosh, he's running that fast and he looks that good. But my thinking is, no, he's running that fast because he looks that good, because he's using his core and his hips so well. That's why he's able to do that. So Yeah, he has a couple little stride quirks. I mean, a lot of people say he tends to be a little bit bouncy, but he is kind of the symbol of probably the most ideal fast guy mechanics you'll see on the trail.
And that bouncy may be just the springiness of youth. You know, that nice, mm-hmm. the elastic properties of ligaments and tendons, giving you a little bounce that people that are younger inherit some spring.
We'll see what it looks like in a couple of years. The other thing that I like to do is, did you guys ever watch Race for the Soul? Western States. Oh my gosh, I love that documentary.
Yeah.
I have that thing memorized. But I'll take my ultra running clients and I'll say, hey, like, look at these guys run. If you guys go, I want to say it's, I don't know, maybe two thirds of the way through, and you watch Scott Jurek finish and Tim Tweetmeyer finish, they come on the track, they're not sprinting, but they have awesome hip mobility and they're leaning forward. And they look like they started their run up at Roby Point and they're, you know, 2 miles in. So my point in showing that to my clients is to say, the reason they're running that fast is because they've had that good form consistently all day. And I've seen Tim run, you know, even recently, and even for his relative maturity, he still has a great stride. And I think that's a big reason why he, and guys like Bruce LaBelle, he's another one. These guys have been running hard, fast, competitive ultras for over 30 years, and they're still doing it. And I think it's because of how efficient they are.
Does everybody in the top 10 have ideal running form? I mean, besides little tiny quirks, like you said, even Jim Walmsley has some quirks, but are top 10 finishers there because they all have good form?
Not me.
Joe, come on.
If I dig up the video from 12, I'm like, oh my God, I'm embarrassed compared to the rest of these guys. And to be honest, you know, and Andy Jones-Wilkins, I mean, he's a great guy, but oh man, he's got some stride issues. And I think he's actually been working on them, you know, in the last year, which is great. But he'll be the first one to say that for better or worse, you can have not very good mechanics and still be in the top 10 of Western States. But it's going to be a difference maker. There is a definitive difference in efficiency between the top 5 and 6 through 10 at Western States for sure. So it shouldn't be this cop out, well, you know, I'm still top 10, I'm fine. Well, no, we should always be looking at what the people just in front of us are doing differently. And for Jim, it's like, for me, watching guys like him run, and it was the same thing. I saw this at Sonoma when Varner broke the record. And when Zach Miller broke the record at Sonoma, what they all three had in common is they like sprinted up the hills. They used their hips so well. So for me, I look up to those guys and like, okay, well, this is the example. This is the bar or the standard that they're setting for mechanical excellence. It's not just like crazy fitness.
I know in the first half of my running career, if you call it a career, just my experience of being out there running, I don't think I've ever bought a sandwich with the money I've made from running. So I never thought about running gait in the first half. Yeah. I never even considered that it was something to think about. And as I look back at some old pictures that I've tried to somehow squash and get in touch with Facebook and ask them to delete them, I had the worst running gait ever seen. I mean, my leg was way out in front. I'm heel striking like I'm trying to
squish a bug.
I'm doing something besides running. And so I do know that it's been much better for me and injury-wise and just enjoyment of thinking about gait. With that, I want to make this statement and see if you know of this study or know some of the results. And since you're such a Western States aficionado, that maybe you do. That a couple years back, maybe it was in 13 or 12, they were doing some running analysis. And as you went by, there were cameras set up and they would ask you, are you a heel striker or a four-foot striker? And almost everybody said they're four-foot strikers or you know, saying, oh, I have perfect gait, you know, rate themselves as a 10. But they would look at different intervals throughout the race and then take a look is your perception reality? And number two, does this form break down throughout the deep miles? And that was part of Marty Hoffman's group studying that out there. Do you know anything about that, Joe?
I do. And one of the interesting findings was they correlated type of foot strike with muscle stress. And they found that the 4 foot strikers had more creatine phosphokinase, or CPK, which is always the big value they measure at Western States, this measure of muscle damage, that those values were significantly higher in 4 foot strikers.
Really?
Yeah. So they, and they, I ran that year, it was 2013, and they filmed us at mile 10, just before Line Ridge. They filmed again at, on Gorman Ranch Road, just past Michigan Bluff. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the only two. They might have done another one. But my only issue with that study, I think it's a great idea, is they're looking at, okay, well, what part of the foot are you landing on? But I'm more interested in, as a runner, as a coach, is where is the foot landing with respect to your body? And you guys have talked about this, this back leaning and leg in front. To me, as a clinician and coach, I don't care what part of the foot you land on. Are you overstriding? In other words, are you landing significantly in front of your body mass? So you can be a, you can be a nasty heel striker. Well, you actually wouldn't be, but you could land on your heel, but if your whole foot is underneath your chest, that's an efficient strike. So I think there's a greater tendency, however, when you do 4 foot strike, that you're kind of tiptoeing foot forward, trunk back. And I think that's probably what they would have found if they had, you know, done a full video analysis of the whole body. They'd see back leaning people with their foot way in front of them, kind of tiptoeing down the trail. And that's stressful.
Yeah, I just want to explore a little bit about that study, which came to mind as you're making the comment. CPK, that's, they're measuring that to see the muscle damage, or just how much the muscles are working in that gait. But I would challenge that with the comment, well, that stress has to go somewhere. And maybe instead of the muscle working harder and absorbing that, it's going right to the joint, whether it's the foot, the ankle, the knee, the hip, the back, somewhere. You can't just dissolve that energy. It's got to go somewhere. And I think I'd rather have the muscle, which can rebound quicker in my mind, than the fatigue of the joint, you know, of just getting buried and a lot of pain receptors on the joints and less time for them to recover. Any thoughts on that?
Well, we're seeing that with studies on the maximal shoes like Hoka and so on, where ground reaction forces are significantly greater wearing those type of shoes compared to not. But I don't think you're feeling it because part of the cushioning is absorbing it. But also I think you're getting more muscle absorption rather than the joint pounding that you might experience in a more minimal shoe. Or at least you would, if you were joint pounding, you would feel that in a minimal shoe a lot more than a maximal shoe. But I guess my point is, and what I try to impress, especially like when a young kid comes to see me and all they care about is getting this injury better, it comes down to the efficiency rule. And the efficiency rule for me is that any form adjustment or change we make that sustainably relieves pain should make you faster. So we don't want any extra energy going anywhere in the body. Let's use that for forward propulsion. Let's take that that injury producing energy out of your legs and shoot it forward. And that's always the end goal.
Any thoughts about the maximum shoe covering up or making the proprioceptive ability, the ability for your body to contract stabilization muscles or protective muscles up the chain above the ankle to where you're unaware of what's happening to your foot till it's too late, till the shock is already up through the knee into the hip, and you lose the opportunity to contract those muscles that can help protect and absorb some of that shock. The cushioned shoe just disguises that impact that's on its way.
Sure. The first I ever heard of that was, again, in Born to Run. Chris McDougall talks about a study of gymnasts, and we had this well-intended thing, let's have gymnasts land on this really thick pad, And what they found by putting a force plate under that pad was that the gymnasts landed harder on the pad than if they did if there was a skinnier pad.
Hmm.
And I've worked in a clinic with a force measuring treadmill, and we found the exact same thing with maximal shoes. Significantly greater ground reaction forces in the maximal shoe compared to a normal shoe or a different shoe or even barefoot. So the theory behind both of those is that the body is looking for stability, and it'll actually land harder to find it.
Hmm. Ooh. I want you to repeat that. That is a gold nugget for this podcast. Repeat that last sentence.
That the body will land harder because it's looking for stability.
That's interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it doesn't have to be that way. So I certainly don't want to be deriding maximal shoes. And Greg McMillan had a really good tweet or post recently where he just said, look, just have a variety of shoes, because the maximal shoes are going to be great when you're really sore. The minimal shoes are going to be good to run fast, and maybe running some barefoot will work on strength and proprioception. There's a place for that, just like there's a place for easy running and hard running and hill running. Variety is almost your best bet. And then overlying all of that is be efficient, whatever you're doing. If you're barefoot, have good stride. If you're maximal shoes, have good stride. If you're anywhere in between, if you're sprinting or running slow, have a good stride. And if you have good stride mechanics and you kind of know what that is, it doesn't matter what you are. You won't be coming down hard in your maximal shoe. You'll get that nice cushioning that people love about them, as long as you're mindful and knowing, okay, well, this is a super comfy shoe. It's going to let me get away with being sloppy. I need to be mindful.
Yeah, so when you're wearing the maximal shoe, make sure you have a barefoot stride.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I do know that in deep miles, it's a 100-mile race or what have you, just something long that you're stretching your limits, it is nice to slide into a maximum cushioning shoe. It's like putting on a pair of clouds.
And to change things up, too, to allow your body to feel something different.
Yeah.
To mess with the central governor.
I don't do this, but I've thought about it. But there's people, and I think like our 24-hour friends like Pam Smith and Zach Bitter, they'll like change clothes. And I think there is something about the central governor where it's like, oh, this is a new run. Scott Jurd talks about it in his book when he ran Badwater and set the record. He's like, I'm going to pretend that I am starting this run fresh all over again. So yeah, there's definitely something of that variety. And I think it's really good.
So the central governor is like the smartest kid in the class, but doesn't have any street sense.
Exactly. That's actually really
That's funny.
Hey, you know, we're talking about gait and about efficiency, and I call back to that one video some years back of Anton Kropitschka in Leadville, where they filmed him at like early mile and, you know, quarter of the way through, halfway, three quarters, and at the end, and you could shuffle those periods up, and his gait looked the same all the way through. I just, that's been impactful.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the video with the French music.
Yep, that's good too. from the side by the lake in slow motion. That is one that I play in my head all the time. But I remember looking at him at that 100-mile Leadville run and just amazed at how consistent that gait looked, regardless of the mile.
Yeah, he is efficient and he is consistent. And
what's his quirk?
Athlete.
What's his quirk, Joe?
That's what I was going to say. So I'm sure you've watched those videos. What does Anton need to work on?
Well, what he does, he does so good is he uses his core better than almost anyone. So I haven't watched a lot of them, but the other video that I watch a ton of is Unbreakable. The 2010 documentary, and watching him, those clips in Boulder of just how well he uses his core. And that's probably what you guys were seeing in those Leadville videos, is it's just this super light and just kind of using his abs and his hips really well. And he doesn't lift his feet off the ground a ton, but that works for him. I mean, you see that a lot for a lot of the best 100 milers, they are a little bit shuffly. What I think where he's run into problems with injuries, and you can read on his blog about, you know, shin issues all the time and having this persistent lower leg stuff, is he does relatively overstride because he's tall. I mean, he's upright and he's a little more too relaxed and back leaning, where he could take a page from Jim Walmsley's book and be a lot more forward leaning. And I think he'd have less lower leg stress.
Would you rather run 25 miles hard or 100 miles hard?
Depends on where.
Okay, well,
on the Western States course. in the canyons in Western
that's
States.
The wonderful thing about the Western States trails, it never seems that far. My favorite run, one of my all-time favorite runs, is going Michigan Bluff to Last Chance and back. And that's 26 miles. And I don't know, what is it, like 8,000 feet of climbing or something?
It's up and down. It's in the heart of the canyons.
That is a more enjoyable, easier run mentally than going out for a 15 miler on a road, to me.
Huh.
So, I mean, I love that. I love, and maybe it's the variety, maybe it's the history and the memories, and I don't know, but there's something special about that trail. So it really does depend. But I think for me, coming back to the skill sets you need to do well in ultras, if you don't have that max speed, well, that's okay. If you can descend really well, and if you can be an awesome hiker, and if you can manage heat, that, and maybe Michigan Bluff to Last Chance is a nice kind of microcosm of the entire distance of you get everything. It'll be cool up high in the shade and hot in the canyon, and you're running downhill, and then you've got some really nice buffed out trail in some parts and some super gnarly. So I like that variety. So I think my answer would be is anything that gives that variety that's not too extreme and still runnable.
For me, I think that I would be more nervous showing up to and apprehensive about the 25-mile hard run, because you really have to get some leg turnover. In 100, you can back off and just stay steady and manage your effort and manage the day. But in 25, you've got to go out and go hard, and it's going to hurt, guaranteed. I don't know where the 100's going to hurt, but I can tell you where 25 is going to hurt. It's going to hurt a long time.
Well, and what I just love so much about Western States is how it's just how it's constructed. And for me, having this emphasis on stride efficiency and also having an emphasis on, you know, sustainable training and good pacing and making sure that you're doing aerobic training and anaerobic training, is that Western States will either reward or punish you equally severely based on how you do those things. And for the stride mechanics, I mean, if you've run reasonably smart at Western States and you've held it together and you've got your, okay, here's my list of, you know, here's my foundational stride things, here are my habits that I kind of shore up, and then when it's time to throw down, this is, you know, what I need to do. If you can take that into the last 38 at Western States, it's awesome. I mean, you can just fly. And that's, you ask the people that love that race, and I think it's because of the experiences they've had getting to 62 miles into a 100 miler and being like, holy crap, I can run. Or crossing the river and getting up to Green Game, like, holy crap, like, we're running 8-minute pace on this flat, which is ridiculous sounding to a road guy, but that is flying. And that's where the reward for the efficiency work and the mindfulness you guys were talking about. And that's what I live for those days when you do get to the end of an ultra that's super runnable and you can run. Like, that's just the best.
You know, that, and there's a lot of mystique about Western States, and we speculate, well, is it because it was first? Is it because we focus on it? Is it because there's a lottery and it's tough to get in? But maybe it's that point that you just said, Joe, it's constructed by chance. It's constructed in a way that allows you to relax into the day in the beginning and enjoy a lot of the scene and some of the downhills. And then it just works you hard in the afternoon. And that's why you show up to some of those events, to be real challenged. So it puts you through the mill in the canyons. But then if you've done what you're supposed to do, you're rewarded on that second, on that last third where you can run. So it is constructed in a way that by someone like puts a golf course together, like who are some of those?
Jack Nicklaus.
The Jack Nicklaus course. You know, you're going to be challenged in a way because you knew he played the game. Somehow this Western States Trail was created by someone that loved to run.
Horses. It was put together by horses.
And nobody loves to run more than a horse.
Actually, I think it was there before the horses ran that trail.
You know, and I'll keep this short, and I know your time is valuable, Joe, and I'm telling a story when we should be draining you for great information like you've provided us. I was out training in Auburn, and I ran with a horse. Not that I was fast, but I had to run pretty hard, but the guy was training his horse up for the Tevis Cup, so he was a horse trail person. And I said, hey, you want by? Because we were talking a little bit. And he goes, no, the horse is enjoying running with you right now. And I thought,
what?
Yeah. And obviously, because he went up a hill and just blew me away later on and had plenty of legs. But I felt such camaraderie, not with the rider, but with the horse. And we were both runners on a trail doing our thing. And when I said, hey, you want the horse to pass? And he said, no, he's enjoying your company right now. And I thought, how cool that was to be sharing the trail with another animal in the same way, in the same level of appreciation. Even though we couldn't communicate, we were both digging it.
And how perceptive of the rider to know.
Yeah, yeah. He knew his horse. He was a good trainer. Yeah.
Maybe his driver's looking really good that day.
the horse was analyzing your gait.
I wasn't leaning back, Joe. I was leaning forward because I had a horse up my, you know what.
Well, there you go.
Hey, if you were to look at Scooby-Doo, Shaggy, tell me about his gait. What would you, if he was your client in closing here, what would you do to help that guy?
I think he needs some better grip on his shoes because they're usually slipping around.
He spins a lot.
My memory.
Yeah, initially he spins, but then he finally gets going, you know, just at the last moment to get out of the grasp of the ghost or whatever's coming up. But then he has a peculiar gait. What would you do after he finally gets going to that guy?
So here's what you guys got to do, and I can't believe that some of my friendlier ultra runners haven't done this. I have on my site a video submission page. So it's basically free estimates for people. Like, all you have to do is upload a video. It's just you could record on your phone. Here's this video, upload it. I haven't been pranked yet.
Oh, you will be.
So, you
calling
know,
for a prank. Yep. You just opened it up.
Then you know, send that up there. But I think I put in ultra fine print that I'm not responsible for anything that you submit. So I could post it if you send something embarrassing.
JoeYuhan.blogspot.com. Tell us about the website. So if we want to upload a video, one that you're talking about, or one so that you can bring some of your running gait efficiencies into our own pair of shoes, where would we find you? How do we get to you?
So my new website is yuhanperformance.com. That's just my last name, UHAN Performance. And that's going to have all of the information. It's got my physical therapy practice information, and then there are a couple tabs on coaching, but then also the running analysis and how that works. And there's just a little bit of information on, okay, well, like we talked about, try this angle, you know, wear contrasting clothes. But all that is details to kind of help both of us see better. But I do then have a link that's video submissions. So it's as easy as going out, getting some video clips, especially if you're curious about something's not feeling right in my stride, or I've got these aches and pains, get some video, upload it, and it automatically gets sent to us, and we'll look at it and see what we can see.
I've mentioned in the past, Jay DeSherry, thanks, that his comment is, if something's going on, then it's because something's going on. He didn't actually say that.
Paraphrasing.
I'm paraphrasing liberally. And so I would encourage others to, if you want to go longer, more efficient, if you have a knee that continues to be the issue when you get in some deeper miles or longer training weeks, take a look at your running efficiency. You spend money on shoes and different things and spend money on race bibs. Spend money on your gait, because that's what you'll have forever. Races and shoes go away, your gait stays with you forever.
Well, I agree with that. And I kind of started my ultra career with some great mentors here in Eugene, running with Craig Thornley and Megan Arbogast. And when I was training with them and learning as much as I could before my first Western States, one of their slogans or sayings is fix your problems. Mm. And that was such like this take action. Okay, if you're having a nutrition issue or a bonking issue, well, fix it. Do something about it. And that does extend to running mechanics. And Megan's a fantastic example of someone who is really mindful about that. And I know you guys have talked to her over the years. But that's a huge part of why she's running as fast and continues to run fast, is she's mindful. But then when there's a problem, she goes after it. So it's all part of that ultra mindset of you have control. If something's not going the way you want it to, well, take the time and fix problems. And that's kind of my mission, as a professional, is to help people get there. It's not about necessarily pain relief. It's doing what you want to do. Running is a fantastic personal and a community experience, and to be able to do what you want to do with the people and the places you want to do is a great thing. And it shouldn't be an injury issue or a stride issue that holds you back.
Joe, thank you for your time, your wisdom. We really appreciate it. If some of the things that Joe has talked about resonate with you, and you want to learn more about what goes on between his ears, you can find him on Twitter and Facebook and all the social media places. You can find him at iRunFar. You can find him in Ultra Running Magazine.
And Google. Google happens to have his address.
Yeah. Actually, if you just Google Joe Juhan, all that stuff pops up.
Yep.
So you can see what he looks like, too. He's a handsome man. Joe, you're a handsome man.
Wow. Thank you. Have a good time.
It's not going to get any better than that, so we better just go ahead and sign off there.
Yeah, you're right. It's all downhill from here.
So
well,
go out and
guys. Appreciate talking with you.
Absolutely. Go out and run.
Moss.